Welcome to The Neutral Ground. This week I'm humbled to introduce my guest, Dr. Alex Hirschaft. Dr. Hirschaft is a Holocaust survivor. At the age of 5 in 1939, he and his family were forced into the Warsaw Ghetto in Poland, where he bore witness to the building of a wall to keep him in and others out. I don't want to give away too many details in this introduction because I'd rather you hear the story directly from him. It's quite an amazing one. I ask him some difficult questions in this conversation, things like, what does he think it is that would lead an individual down a pathway to such evil, or to participate in such heinous acts? But I also ask him about the good. I ask him if he saw any pockets of goodness in the world that kept him connected to humanity. And his answer to that question is quite remarkable. You're going to want to hear it. When he left Poland and made his way to the United States, Dr. Hirschaft continued his education all the way up through to receiving a PhD in inorganic chemistry, which actually led, interestingly enough, to his eventual co-founding and becoming the current president of FARM, which stands for Farm Animal Rights Movement. Now, although I'm not a vegetarian, I do believe that how we treat animals can sometimes be a mirror into how we think of each other. In honor of Dr. Hirschaft, I thought I might introduce an animal friend of mine. Let me go get him. For those of you watching the YouTube channel, this is Watson, aka The Pups, and he is the greatest dog of all time. If you're just listening to this on a podcast platform, you can use the link in the show notes to head on over. And I mean, come on, you don't want to head on over to see me. You want to head over to see this guy. He's adorable, absolutely wonderful. He's an amazing part of our family. This is an incredibly powerful episode. I hope you are moved by my episode with Dr. Alex Hirschaft. Dr. Hirschaft, welcome to The Neutral Ground. You have an incredible story to tell, from surviving the Holocaust to receiving a PhD to becoming a tremendous advocate for animals through your wonderful organization, Farm Animal Rights Movement. And of course, I'd like to begin by asking you to tell your story from about the age of 5, as best as you can recollect, when you realized that something truly terrible was happening.
Sure, Joe. First of all, let me thank you for inviting me on your Neutral Ground podcast. It's a pleasure to be with you. So back to my story. I was 5 years old when the Nazi armies invaded Poland and declared martial law. Within about a year, all Jews in the greater Warsaw area were required to move into the Jewish section of Warsaw. We most obviously had to move in with strangers, which was very awkward. We were lucky in that my grandparents had a large apartment in the Jewish section, so we were able to move in with them. So we were relatively comfortable. Most people were not as lucky, and they had tremendous people density, as many as 4 or 5 people per room, which increased the likelihood of the typhus pandemic, which was rampant throughout the ghetto. Anyway, during the... So by November of the following year, of 1940, we saw a wall going up around our section, topped with barbed wire, and we realized within a few days that the infamous Warsaw Ghetto was born, which turned out to be just another concentration camp where people were kept together until the Nazis were ready to build their gas chambers in Treblinka, about 60 miles northeast of Warsaw. So the first year, basically, hunger and typhus took their toll, and it's estimated that that is between 80 and 100,000 people were lost to hunger and typhus. The total number in the ghetto was 450,000 of us. In the summer of 1942 is when the Nazis initiated their so-called final solution, which was basically to murder all European Jews. European because they were more convenient, we were more reachable, because by then all of Europe had been invaded by the Nazi armies. But I'm sure that eventually it would be Jews in other countries as well, in other continents. So basically what it involved they built basically five extermination camps. Treblinka was one of them, one of the biggest. Auschwitz was obviously the biggest and the most notorious. Other were Helmno, Bergen-Belsen. At all these places, people were basically gassed and cremated. We were pretty lucky in that my parents and I were able to escape by bribing the guards. And then we spent 2.5 years in hiding on the Christian side outside the ghetto under false papers, because any suspicion of being Jewish was basically a death sentence. There were no trials.
How were you able to escape?
Well, different ways. So in my personal case, it's kind of a longer story, but I'll try to make it quick. We had a Russian maid, we meaning my grandparents, my grandparents spent a lot of time in Russia before the war. They had business in Russia. So they had this maid who was basically part of the family. They only spoke Russian with her, and she lived with them. She had her own room, and yeah. So when the order came that all Jews had to move into the Jewish section, that same order also specified that any Gentiles had to move out of the ghetto. And the young lady, her name was Yuliana, refused to move out. She said my grandparents were the only family she ever had. She was very interested in Russian culture, obviously, since she only spoke Russian. And one of the smart things she did before the war was the only center for Russian culture in Warsaw, really, at that time, was maintained by something called the White Russians. These were refugees from the Russian Revolution, and the Germans cultivated them because they were hoping that once they conquered Russia, that these people would become their puppets in running the Russian country. So they had quite a bit of favor with the Nazi regime. So Yuliana went to them, and she said that she told her story, and she threatened to commit suicide if she couldn't stay with us. So they gave her two permits. The first one was to go in and out of the ghetto, which was, the first one was to stay in the ghetto, so she could stay with us. But the second permit was even more important, which was that she could go in and out, which basically saved our life, because it meant that she could take valuables like clothing, jewelry, and just put them on her person and take them outside and trade them for food and then bring food back to us. So we never really starved. We were really very fortunate in that we had a nice apartment and we had food. So we were among the very privileged residents of the Warsaw Ghetto. In the summer of 1942, when the roundups happened, when they started rounding up people from their homes in the street for the transport by cattle cars to the gas chambers of Treblinka, she was out on one of her runs and she got caught up and she was basically barely able to extricate herself, even with all her White Russian permits. When she finally got home, my grandmother, who ran the household, decided that things were getting too dangerous and that Yulia and I had to leave. And there was a lot of crying and screaming. And finally, Yuliana agreed to leave, but only on one condition, which is to take me with her as her son so that I would live. And my grandparents had some jewelry, which was very fortunate. They made up three little piles of jewelry. One was for Yuliana to give to the guard at the gate. So they knew her, but all of a sudden she had a 10-year-old son. The second batch was for the hooligans, the Polish hooligans who were gathering outside the ghetto gates so they could basically hold up escaping Jews. And the third one was for Yuliana, so she could start a new life outside the ghetto. So Yuliana brought me to my aunt, my father's sister, who was a famous Polish actress, and she passed as Christian, so she did not go into the ghetto. And then the way my parents got out is by joining, there were tasks that the Polish people wouldn't do, mostly things having to do with handling garbage or sewage or just the real dirty jobs. So they used Jews from the ghetto. And so a whole group would go out, and of course they had their Star of David armbands and they were under guard. And so what they did is they basically bribed the guard, not to the extent that he would let them go, but to the extent that if they separated from the group when the group was turning a corner, they wouldn't come chasing after them. So they could always claim that they didn't notice if somebody asked. So that's how they got out, one at a time, not at the same time. Long answers to short questions.
I think it's important. I these stories are really important to me, especially because I'm someone who studies story a lot. My PhD is in early American literature. I value story, and so this is wonderful. If you don't mind me asking, you're surrounded by so much just hatred. And just evil. It would have been very understandable for you to just write off humanity at that point, even at such a young age, and just hate. It sounds like Yuliana was one kind of good that was there. Were there any other pockets of good at that time that you might recall that kept you connected to humanity?
Yes. Yes, they're generally referred to as righteous Gentiles. Hmm. Yeah, there were two more. One was our story in hiding goes on for a long time. Well, I mean, imagine 2.5 years with constantly moving from place to place. So on one of those cases, we were out in the countryside, the countryside was little, well, on one hand, it was worse because everybody knew everyone. So a stranger really stood out. And there were really only two reasons for somebody to be a stranger in and around Warsaw. One was if they were a member of the resistance, and the other was if they were a Jew in hiding. So if you weren't a member of the resistance, you were probably a Jew. So, but the nice part about them was that you didn't have to register. So, for example, if you moved in Warsaw from one place to another, you had to register out of where you were and register in. So for example, we were staying in Warsaw initially, and we heard the neighbors gossiping about who are these new people, probably Jews. And so we immediately moved out. Now, if we moved into another section of Warsaw, it would be a dead giveaway. You know, why did they move out within a week after moving in? Obviously, they're running away. So what's their new address? Let's go and get them. But if you move to the country, you could just, at least you were untraceable to the people in Warsaw. You had to deal with the new people, but you were not trackable by the people in Warsaw. So anyway, my mother was, so the question came up of income. We had no money. We had to generate some income. So what she did is she used to travel to Warsaw and buy used clothing at the street markets, and usually Jewish clothing from, you know. And then she would repair it and mend it and launder it, and then carry it in a backpack to the surrounding villages and sell it. And my mother was very friendly and pretty, and she became very popular. People really liked her, and got to the point where she became a regular, and people started actually ordering specific items, different sizes, colors, and so forth, just like you would in a department store. So one day she was walking through the village, and through one of the villages, and one of her friends said, you know, you think this is crazy. I'm embarrassed to tell you. And she says, no, tell me. I've heard all kinds of things. I said, well, you know, this merchant over here, he's a Volksdeutsch. Volksdeutsch is basically a Polish person of German origin, and they were favored by the Germans. Says this Volksdeutsch over here, he thinks you're Jewish. And my mother thought that was really funny. They both had a big laugh. And my mother calmly kept walking. She turned the corner, dropped her backpack, and started running back to where I was, back to the farmhouse. By the time she reached the farmhouse, it was midnight. The farm woman that we were staying with had three sons. She didn't want to divide the farm among them because she didn't want them to be fighting with each other. So she sent two of the sons to Warsaw to learn a trade, and the remaining son stayed with her to run the farm. So when my mother was going to Warsaw to buy clothing, she also would bring food from the farm to the two sons. So she came running and said to the farm woman, I have to get to the train immediately. And the farm woman woke up her son without a question and had him, hook up the horses to the carriage, took us to the train station and we were off back to Warsaw. After the war, when my mother came back from, she ended up in the labor camp as a Christian. But when she came back, she found the two sons because she knew where they were living. And through the sons, she got hold of the mother. And she said to her, you know, I came to you in the middle of the night and you didn't ask any questions. You didn't hesitate. What was going through your mind? And the woman just looked at her and said, hell, I knew you were Jewish from the moment I saw you. I don't care about these things.
Wow.
So there was a second one. The third one was, as I said, my mother was very attractive in both in looks and in manner. And when during one of her stays in Warsaw, she got into a romantic relationship with a man who was in charge of the finance department for the Warsaw government. And my mother had a problem of, so my father was staying separately. He was being hidden by some resistance workers who were friendly with my aunt. But he was in a precarious position still. The nice thing about working for the Warsaw government is if you had one of their caps and their ID card, you were very unlikely to be bothered by the Germans because they didn't want to get involved with running the city. So she asked this man if he would find a job for my dad. She said my dad was a friend. And so he created basically a job, you know, sort of the same way that today we create jobs in government. It just basically start complaining that there's too much work and create a vacancy. So he created vacancy for my dad and he said, you know, I need a photograph for the ID card. He saw the photograph and he became silent. And my mother said, what's the matter? And he said, he has Jewish eyes. And my mother said, okay, in this case, I relieve you of your promise, of your pledge. In fact, he is my husband. And he said, that's okay. I will still do it because I love and appreciate you. And he did. And he basically saved my father's life until much later. So that was our third righteous Gentile. Again, wow. Long answers to short questions.
Oh, my goodness. So, well, let me ask you this then. What do you think it is that makes a man like that merchant, let's say the gentleman who you know, said that your mother was Jewish and he had no proof, he had none of the, what is it that puts, that goes into a person's heart that makes them do something you think so terrible and despicable?
Right. So I really have not given that much thought, but I would have to do some guessing. So first of all, you remember that, maybe you don't remember, but you should know that Poland was thoroughly steeped in anti-Semitism. There was no pretense that Jews were okay. It was okay to discriminate against Jews among most people. Now the intelligentsia, the university people, they were very accepting. My parents were scientists, and they were totally accepted by their peers. But the general population, yeah, I mean, we were Christ killers, and yeah, we were just the worst. So it wasn't just Germany. In fact, anti-Semitism was worse in Poland than in Germany, because in Germany, the German Jews were pretty assimilated. It really took quite an effort to break them out of the general population by the Nuremberg laws. And so that's one thing. And also as a Volksdeutsch, he probably felt as a privileged person, and as a privileged person, he had a debt to pay, which is to demonstrate his loyalty to the Nazi government. And one way to do that was to report a possible Jew.
I heard you mention in another interview the role that norms play in societies. Can you speak a little bit about that? Because I think that connects with what you just said as well.
Well, it connects with everything. I mean, we like to think that we live by our religion or by a personal code or by what our parents taught us. We really live by the social norms that surround us. And they are on different levels. Of course, we have national norms. We have our city's norms. We have our group norms, our family norms. And some of those norms make no sense whatsoever. You know, like the very idea of discriminating against certain people because of their sexual orientation or their race or their nationality. You know, there is no logic in it. You know, it's just social norms. And the question comes up, how do these social norms arise? Well, this is the frightening part, because we generally think of social norms as taking many years to establish themselves. You know, like you think, for example, how long it took for Christianity to assert itself after the fall of the Roman Empire. It took, you know, several hundred years. I mean, you think of the Dark Ages, the 700-800 years and so forth. And so you usually think, but what happened in Germany was that Hitler was able to turn social norms upside down within 3 years of taking power in January of 1933, which is absolutely amazing and extremely frightening, that he could take basically an enlightened country, not unlike ours, and just totally turn norms upside down. And the reason he was able to do that was because people who disagreed were afraid to speak up, because there was so much social pressure to get along, to go along, to get along, so to speak, in terms of social acceptance. And, you know, we have, I don't want to draw invidious comparisons, but we have a little bit of that here today.
Yeah, it feels very divided, and it feels like there is a tremendous amount of pressure on us to, at the very least, cling to some side. And that's something that I'm always aware of and always kind of fear, is that urge that I see others have to kind of move to a side, to be a part of a team. To me, that's absolutely horrifying.
This is not unprecedented, at least in my own lifetime. When I first emigrated to the United States in 1951, we had something called McCarthyism. I don't know if you're probably not old enough to remember.
No, but please, yes. You know, if anybody doesn't know in the audience, please let them know, yes.
Yeah, well, basically, It came shortly. So this was during an era when the Cold War was just getting going. It was 5 years after the end of World War II, and you know, initially we were allies with Russians, of course, during World War II. But after the war, there was that famous Yalta Agreement between Stalin and Churchill, and Roosevelt to divide Europe between this, but particularly Germany, between the Russian sector, the English sector, and the French sector, and so forth. And basically, you know, Churchill said that declared famously that an iron curtain had fallen over Europe. Which was, you know, there was a lot of truth to that. It actually took the form of a wall. there was a wall that was strung across Berlin, and there was an East Berlin and a West Berlin. Mm-hmm. And relations got very cold very quickly between Russia and what was becoming the Soviet Union and the United States. And then there was the famous Rosenberg trial, where this couple was tried and convicted and sentenced to death for giving secrets about the atom bomb to the Russians. So there was Senator Joseph McCarthy from Wisconsin who started railing against communism and started accusing people of being communist sympathizers, and it really caught on and basically got to the point where almost anybody could accuse almost anybody mm-hmm. of either being a communist or what they called a fellow traveler, which meant communist sympathizer. And that's all it took. There was no trial, there was no evidence, they would immediately lose their job. It was the end of their career, the end of their social acceptance. They became a non-person, non-entity, you know. I mean, they weren't imprisoned or anything. They didn't lose their liberty or their property, but they were totally rejected by society, which for some people, yeah, it's a big deal.
Now, in your eyes, even though you're still, you know, quite a young man at that time, my guess is it didn't take you long to see the parallels and see there's a real problem here that people are not taking seriously enough. Did you try to explain to people? And if so, how did they take it?
Well, I was, you know, I was only 16, 17.
You were very young, yeah.
And I was kind of alone and trying to figure out how to go
live.
On. I mean, you know, nobody was threatening my life, at least. So that was nice. But I had to, you know, make a living and try to get an education.
Yeah, of course. For the education part of this, what led you to want to not just get, let's say, a bachelor's degree, but you pushed all the way through to a PhD? What was it about that made you push that far in your education?
Right. Okay, you're challenging me, and I'm going to go a little beyond my sphere of competence here. So this is sheer guesswork.
Okay.
People sometimes wonder why Jews are so successful, and my guess is that it's all cultural. Is that a Jewish child is kind of expected to succeed. it's a culture that, and the reason for that was because we were so repressed and oppressed that you had to kind of fight your way out. I'm guessing. Mm-hmm. So to me, it was always understood that I would follow in my father's footsteps. My father was a PhD in chemistry. And then especially after I lost him, you know, that was like a memorial to him. It never came up in a conversation. It was something I always knew that, and that I was not free until I got my PhD in chemistry. Then I could reclaim the rest of my life.
Interesting. So it was almost a means of attaining freedom. That's really fascinating. But it makes sense the way you explained it. It does. It makes sense. And you achieve your PhD, but then you also have, and correct me if I'm wrong, you have a calling roughly around 1976 in terms of turning your attention toward animals. Now, how did that happen? How did that connection happen in your life for that turn?
Right. So I kind of had a problem with eating animals for some time. I didn't know anything about it, but just the concept of taking a beautiful animal like a dog or a goat or a sheep and hitting him over the head and cutting up his body into little pieces and then shoving those pieces in my mouth, it just felt kind of disgusting, frankly. So in 1961, I stopped doing that. I stopped eating animals. I didn't quite have any good reasons. It was kind of an aesthetic decision. Back then, there was general notion that you needed to eat animals to survive. That notion prevailed. I know nobody's in your audience will believe this. But until Frances Moulin Peck came out with her famous book, Diet for a Small Planet, everyone believed that you had to have meat to survive. And I did. I mean, I had a PhD in chemistry. I read, I was an educated person. We didn't have internet, but, you know, I read books. And I was totally convinced that, yeah, that that's what would happen. So I figured that before dying, I would get sick. And then I would maybe just grab some bites of a hamburger or something till I got well again. And then I would resume not eating animals. You know, I would take it like medication. Of course, that was all fiction, as it turned out. But we didn't know it back then. So that was the first step. Then in 1972, I moved to Washington, ended up working for an environmental consulting firm. My specialty was hazardous waste management, actually, because of my chemistry background. And they sent me to a Midwestern slaughterhouse to do an inventory of their wastewater issues. So I was walking around taking notes, you know, where all their waste was coming from. And I turned a corner and I saw these piles of body parts, you know, hooves and heads and hearts and lungs. And I mean, I recalled in horror. I mean, theoretically, I knew that I was in a slaughterhouse, but I didn't really materialize that. I didn't actualize that. You know, it was a theoretical concept. Basically, I was thinking of it as a factory. It's just another factory with a wastewater problem. But this, seeing these body parts, really, really shocked me. And I immediately got flashbacks to the pictures of human body parts in Auschwitz, you know, where you see these piles of human hair and suitcases and shoes and clothing, you know, the remains of the victims. And I started comparing, and the more I thought about it, the more it made sense, the more it didn't make sense. I mean, the more the comparison made sense. There were so many similarities in the process of killing. And I didn't understand until much later about the motives, and which we can get into, which is a little more complicated. But the techniques were so similar that I immediately thought, you know, here I am in my new country, you know, that gave me freedom, gave me an education, and that I'm so grateful to, and I want to succeed, and yet it's how am I going to confront what we're doing to animals with what was done to us? And I was on the verge of losing my sanity. I mean, I couldn't discuss it with anyone because no one else, or at least I didn't know anyone else who shared this extreme view. And it was not until I read some of the works by Isaac Bashevis Singer, where one of his characters says that for the animals, all men are Nazis, and for the animals, life is an eternal Treblinka. And I finally realized that at least one other person, no less than a Nobel laureate, shares this view. So the other thing that was going on with me at that time is I had what some people refer to as survivor's guilt. I wanted to know, you know, why was I able to survive when so many people didn't? And I realized that it was a bit of luck, and was my grandparents' jewelry had a lot to do with it. But the more pertinent question was, how could I repay my debt for having survived? And the other question was, you know, this terrible tragedy happened. Do we draw any lessons from it? You know, we were comforting ourselves during the Holocaust by repeating this mantra of never again. And the idea was, yes, we're suffering terribly, we're getting exterminated. But because what's being done to us is so horrible that the world will never again commit genocides. So we were kind of thinking ourselves as the noble victims, if you will. But of course, after the war, we realized that that was a dream, that there was Rwanda, and there was Bangladesh, and there was Serbia, and the Pol Pot regime, and yeah, many other genocides. So that went out the window. So I figured, well, there has to be something we can learn from it. And so my construct was, you know, if we can learn that there are, if we can learn what brings people to commit atrocities in the first place, maybe that is the lesson that we can learn from it. So that's sort of where I was in the early 70s. And then in 1975, I was still pretty private about my vegetarianism because I still didn't know any other vegetarians. But I came across a leaflet about the World Vegetarian Congress taking place in Orono, Maine, in August of 1975. And I went there, and it was truly a life-changing experience. I found myself with about 1,500 people, from all countries and all languages and all forms of dress and all ages and all economic stations. And all they had in common is that they were all vegetarians. They didn't eat animals. And it was such a relief to find normal people who were sharing this abstract, strange concept of not eating animals, that I just felt I was finally among my people. And that's when I made the final resolution to devote the rest of my life to fighting all oppression, but starting first and foremost with the oppression of animals for food.
When you found that community of like-minded thinkers, and you no longer had to, because you didn't have to justify your choice to them, did it free up your mind to explore other things, other avenues to help, and even explore that idea of survivor's guilt within yourself? Did it again give you that concept of freedom?
Well, the concept of freedom, but also it answered my two basic questions: what can I do to repay my debt, and what's the lesson that we can learn from the Holocaust?
I want to give you some time here to talk about your wonderful organization, because it's been ongoing now for quite a long time, and you've put a lot of work and a lot of love into it. Can you tell us a little bit about it and about its goals, its origins, and where you are today?
Yeah, sure. So the Farm Animal Rights Movement was actually born the following year, 1976. It was under the name of Vegetarian Information Service. And then in 1981, in the late 70s, while I was running the Vegetarian Information Service, I also did a couple of small conferences. And at these conferences, I ran into people who were advocating animal rights, which to me sounded like today advocating for the rights of trees or rocks. It didn't make any sense, but I liked two things about those people. One was that they seemed pretty smart, despite advocating a strange concept. And the other was that they were ending up in the same place as we were, that we shouldn't eat animals. And the other thing I liked about them is they had a lot of energy and enthusiasm. Whereas by the late 70s, the vegetarian movement had kind of settled down. You know, you could no longer call a local TV station and say, "I'm a vegetarian, would you like to interview me?" It was no longer a novelty, you know. And became kind of a social movement, you know, that local vegetarians would get together once a month for dinner and social. It wasn't really a social action movement, whereas the animal rights people wanted to change society. So I figured, okay, well, let's get together and talk. So in 1981, I arranged a conference for all the animal rights people and the vegetarian leaders. And it basically became the birthplace of the animal rights movement. It's at Cedar Crest College in Allentown, Pennsylvania, in August of 1981. So one of the organizations that was formed there, of course, was my own farm. And it was really the first organization in the world, I believe, that was formed specifically to fight on behalf of animals used for food. And for the first 20 years of our movement, we were the only organization working on behalf of animals raised for food. The rest of the movement was totally absorbed with anti-vivisection. So anyway, what did we do? Well, of course, we continued the conferences, and that became a major unifying factor for the animal rights movement each year. And then we also launched World Day for Farmed Animals. We launched something called the Great American Meetout. We had vans visiting college campuses and rock concerts, showing videos promoting veganism. I'm kind of pretty much retired and just getting started on my a couple of books here.
Yeah, I'll be placing links in my episode notes. I'll put meetout.org as well, and any other ones that you might have that you want me to put in, I'll put those in the episode notes as well. I have one question for you left. You've seen all of this in your life, all these experiences. What keeps you hopeful about the human race?
Oh, it's not necessarily hopeful about the human race. It's kind of a selfish notion. I mean, it's my answer to the question of what's the meaning of life, you know, unless you can do some good, you know, what is the meaning of life? Yeah, you kind of, I mean, it's nice to go on vacations and to watch movies and to play games, which I'm totally in favor of. But that's not the meaning of life. That's recreation. Life has to have some meaning, and you actualize that meaning by improving the lives of people around you and animals around you, sentient beings.
Well, Dr. Hershaft, I can't think of a better way to end this than on that note, that we all, for meaning, we have to go out, and you can't just believe in good, you have to do it. You have to do good. Thank you so much. This was absolutely, truly an honor to sit here with you and listen to your story.
My pleasure. It was probably the most stimulating podcast I've done.
Oh my goodness. Well, thank you so much for that. I appreciate it. I hope you were moved by my episode with Dr. Alex Hershaft, a truly remarkable individual. I'm trying hard to make a push here to gain some new eyes and ears for the podcast, but I need your help. Head over to my YouTube channel through the link provided in the show notes and hit the subscribe button. And do one more thing for me if you can, please. Leave a kind comment in the section for this video. If you would rather help off of YouTube, you can leave a kind rating or review on Apple Podcasts or wherever reviews are collected. And definitely share an episode of the Neutral Ground podcast with your friends on social media. But understand, I'm grateful for your having taken the time to listen to this at all. Until next time, try to keep one foot firmly planted on the neutral ground. And have a great day.